out a situation, and it calls for a solution that upholds our domination of the planet. We're gonna make our case, and we're gonna make it well. And if you don't like our logic, you can can it. We'll use impeccable intelligence from any country in the world, as long as we all see eye to eye. And if we don't find quite what we need, we know what to do. Just look into the camera and lie. It's Operation Iraqi Liberation. Tell me, what does that spell? Operation Iraqi Liberation. O-I-L. We'll lie about the missiles and the nuclear research. We'll lie about uranium. We'll build military bases and smile for reporters as we give away bubble gum. We'll lie about Bin Laden, his connections with the Saudis. We'll lie about 9-1-1. We'll lie about the Baathists, their connections to Al-Qaeda, because we know there's none. It's Operation Iraqi Liberation. Tell me, what does that spell? Operation Iraqi Liberation. O-I-L. We'll lie about the North Koreans, and we'll lie about Iran, and don't mention Israel. Keep those nuclear weapons out of this song, and we'll all get together swell. And we'll liberate these people, we'll liberate their money, we'll liberate their soil, we'll liberate their airports, we'll liberate their harbors, and we'll liberate their oil. It's Operation Iraqi Liberation. Tell me, what does that spell? Operation Iraqi Liberation. O-I-L. Operation Iraqi Liberation. Tell me, what does that spell? Operation Iraqi Liberation. O-I-L.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program is Confronting Climate Change. The urgency of the climate crisis has compelled writers such as Bill McKibben and Antonia Pujas to cross the line into advocacy. Bill McKibben says that 75% of Americans know that climate change is real and want something done about it.
A couple of the oil companies, we had the president of Shell Oil here a couple few days ago, they have a $40 per ton shadow price on carbon. Now, that's kind of funny money, but they're out there saying, we anticipate a world where there's a real price on carbon.
But we're going to fight like hell to make sure it doesn't
make it
happen.
Later rather than sooner.
The word with capture, where capture should be, is the price of oil should be high, the price of gasoline should be high. The question is, who's capturing that money and where is it going? Right now, a $100 barrel for oil, between the fact that the oil industry is also engaged in speculative futures trading as our hedge funds, as our banks, which is also unregulated and also driving the price of oil up, they are capturing the benefit. If we instead forced the high price of oil and the high price of gasoline and the high price of coal to be captured by governments in the form of taxation that is immediately invested in moving us toward the alternatives, the high price would function in a completely different way. It would function towards moving us towards alternatives, making it less interesting to the industry because they're getting less out of it and therefore making these places where they're operating less
And the high price is funding the tar sands and all these things. It's providing revenue streams to do that. Let's talk about stranded assets. There's been a lot of talk lately about a carbon bubble. I heard David Blood, who's an investment partner with Al Gore, say recently that there's going to be stranded assets. And if it's not going to be carbon in the ground, it's going to be cities and schools and other types of assets. And so there's different bets on which assets are going to be stranded. So Bill McKibben, explain for us the carbon math and
stranded. This was the math that underlay this piece in Rolling Stone, in a sense, okay? What it said was that these guys have five times the amount of carbon that we could safely burn if we
and
wanted
you're saying
to stay
all
below
fossil
2
fuel
degrees,
companies.
All taken together, if we wanted to stay below 2 degrees. So that gives you two choices. Either you bust the planet and raise the temperature 4 or 5 degrees and let these guys burn it and recover all the money they're expecting to recover now, and their share price stays whole and whatever, or you bust them. You say, we can't do this because it will wreck the planet for geologic time, at which point, according to recent studies from HSBC and Citigroup, you'd lower the valuation of the fossil fuel stocks about 40 to 60%. Okay? So just be clear, that's what we're doing. That's the decision at the moment that we're making, is that we'd rather break the planet than lower the valuation of Shell 40%. Okay? And make it clear, too, that if you're willing to invest in these companies, then that's the bet you're making, that no one will ever regulate them. And so you'll get to keep, you know, you'll get to make whatever money you're making off them. If you had any hope that someone was going to regulate these companies and try to keep those carbon reserves in the ground, if you had any hope of that, then it would be a bad bet to make. You'd be sitting on a bubble. That's bubble that we're trying to help pop with this divestment campaign. And you know what? Given the arcane nature of all of this, it's been pretty exciting to watch how quickly this campaign has built and how many people are understanding its importance.
It's certainly gained attention of people quickly, but it's a bet that the political will not happen. Is there any evidence that people are starting to short these stocks or bet on the other side of this yet, or is it too early? They're thinking.
No, I don't think there's any evidence of it yet. I think the oil companies remain serene in their belief that nothing can touch them, but I think that they're wrong. We'll find out. In fact, I know that they're wrong. Eventually, we're going to try and do something about all this. The interesting question is, will we try to do it before, in a time period that still allows us to have some chance of it making a difference? At a certain point, you know, look, one of the reasons that they should not be serene is that Mother Nature continues to provide an incredible array of teachable moments here, each of which, last October, in the greatest city in the world, the public transit system got filled up with the Atlantic Ocean, you know. If you had some sense that somehow our technological civilization was invulnerable, it should have ended right then and there, okay? And for a lot of people, it did. Mm-hmm. And as time goes on, more and more and more of this. The question now is just, can that reality catch up with the artificial reality created by this industry? Can it overwhelm their ability to keep Congress? I mean, at a certain point, they'll falter. They won't be able to keep Congress in line. They won't be able to be just too much pressure. The question is, will that come in time to do any good or not? And on that, it's reasonable to be pessimistic because we don't have much time.
If you're just joining us on the radio, our guest today at Climate One are Bill McKibben, founder of 350.org and author of Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet. We also have Antonia Yuhas, author of Black Tide and a fellow at the Investigative Reporting Program at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. Get that right? Been talking a lot about these guys and they burn it. The reality is we smoke the stuff that they sell. And so I want to talk about individual responsibility. And we can frame it on oil or even other areas where people don't want to pay more for certain products. They don't want to make lifestyle trade-offs. We want to live the way we do we want to solve this problem without making any sacrifices in our comfort or convenience or lifestyle. Antonia?
Yeah, I think the first thing is we are making changes. Actually, we've been looking at the divestment movement, but a community in New Mexico just topped all of us and just passed a resolution that said they will not go after the natural gas and fracking through fracking and the oil that they have within their community. They're going to leave it in the ground because they think it's better to leave it in the ground than to produce it. And they said, we're not going to produce this. Ecuador has been trying to do a similar activity for some time, not particularly successfully. Also, in the United States, we hit our peak of oil and gasoline consumption in 2007. People thought it would go back up as the economy picked up, but it turns out it's not just the economy that's motivating people. People are actually shifting because of policy to more fuel-efficient cars because they want to.
And they don't even want to drive anymore. Young people, the number of miles driven by young people has dropped 23% in the last decade. I don't know. I mean, every young person in America just wants to move to Brooklyn and drive, you know, ride a bike every place they go, you know.
And interact on their cell phone instead of, yeah.
Well, but I mean, people are actually getting it and they're actually doing something about it. So that's, you know, the positive story. We are changing our demand and consumption activity within the United States, which is still the largest consumer in the world. So it's still important. I think the piece is, as I said before, it's putting in place policies that make it possible for those individual choices to turn into collective action and to making those individual choices more possible and affordable. So really it is about, in the United States in particular, it is about public transportation. I don't own a car, I've never owned a car, because I've had the advantage of living in major cities within the United States which have world-class public transit systems. It makes it possible for me not to have a car. That's not true in so many places, even within major cities in the United States. And also we want to lead by example. So we want to help through whatever means we can for China and India and other developing countries that are turning towards cars to instead have the assistance that they need to move instead toward that much more healthy, happy idea of public transportation and not moving around in cars, and to not see it as a personal sacrifice, but rather to see it in the way of all the things that we're going to gain, you know, our planet being one of them. But, you know, it's actually, there's a study that just came out in London which shows that people are actually happier when they take public transportation overall in their lives. There's a happiness coefficient, which is because it's not just the frustration of driving, it's actually the social interaction of sitting on a bus, sitting in a community group while you move around, which makes people happier. So it's what you will gain by giving up your car.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Chicago, just to sing. In a land that's known as freedom, how can such a thing be fair? Won't you please come to Chicago for the help that we can bring? We can change the world. We are ready.
I don't know what bus you ride, but the bus I ride, everyone's on their iPods, iPads, and they're like not looking at anyone, and they're in their own little world.
You know, it's
world,
not just, but it's not even just public transit either. You know, when we were all, many of us were in Copenhagen for the tremendous disaster of the Copenhagen Climate Summit. In fact, the only cheerful thing of the entire week for me was watching as half of Copenhagen commuted to work through the snow and slush on their bicycles without paying a single, you know, without seeming to think it odd or self-sacrificing, or it's just what they did. And they've set up the city so it's easy to do. You know, there's bike highways and bike stoplights, and, you know, and they don't insist, you know, like none of them were wearing Lycra and trying to go incredibly fast, you know, through the whole thing. They were just riding their bikes to work, and it was great. Everybody I know who works on this stuff long ago changed their light bulbs and did all those sort of things. And when they did it, they understood this is an important thing to do, and it's not going to stop climate change. This is a structural problem, and the structures need to change. And the reason the structures can't change is because of power. And so we have to build some. It's remarkably, at some level, remarkably uncomplicated.
I recently heard Al Gore talk at Stanford, and he said our democracy has been hacked. He talked about climate and also campaign funding. Mm. And I'd like to hear about the Democracy Initiative, which is some groups coming together to look at some of the campaign funding and some of that side of structural issues that affect policy outcomes.
Well, I mean, I think it's incredibly important. I also think that, you know, people have talked for a long time about campaign finance reform and all. It's very difficult to do, in part because the system we have at the moment, by definition, the people who are in charge of it have prospered under the current system, mm-hmm. and so it's hard to get them to change. But it's also hard because people's eyes glaze over when people bring up, I mean, it's just very hard to build a movement. I think that the way, and I think Antonia said this sort of in passing before, the way to really challenge the rule of money in Washington may be to go after the fossil fuel industry, which is the worst offender and has this great vulnerability that they're destroying the planet in the course of doing this. If we can bring them down a peg or two, it will have a great and salutary effect in kind of opening those discussions in D.C. They're really important that we all keep working on them. We work with people like United Republic to try and change things and stuff. But look, I mean, the fossil fuel industry is the heart of this thing. The Koch brothers didn't, you know, make their money selling soda pop or whatever else. They made their money selling oil, and they'll continue to. And so did an awful lot of the other people who are corrupting our system.
Other part of the system is it's really predicated on growth. And we've had a lot of people here who say that ultimately, you know, growth, we can have green growth, but still the idea of perpetual quarterly growth is a structural problem. And no one really has a solution for capitalism that doesn't grow more and more, built on more and more and more. I'd like to get your thoughts on whether even, say, we had a green economy, we'd still be growing and there would still be the intense resource extraction and consumption that is part of the problem. Antonia?
I think clearly there's we've identified for some time that there's a fundamental problem with judging a healthy society based on producing more and more things. Obviously, our globe can't sustain such an idea, and if we had any reason to believe that producing more and more and more for less and less and less is problematic, the fire and deaths of 300 people in Bangladesh making cheap clothes for as cheaply as possible is really good evidence that that's problematic. And you know, there's been lots of great economic writing on there's all sorts of other ways that we could instead measure GDP and create a healthy economy which isn't based on this idea of the model of growth that is currently the determinant that we use for GDP. But I actually want to go back really quickly to this issue of democracy and the companies, because I think it's so critical. You know, I went to graduate school in public policy at Georgetown. I worked on Capitol Hill. I did the D.C. thing for 12 years. And almost every single year of that time, I thought that what everyone of us needed to do for 1 year is do absolutely nothing else but focus on campaign finance reform, because nothing else we were doing was going to matter unless we did. And that has only continued to be more insightful that I thought of back then. It's funny how it worked that way. But the truth is we actually can do it because we've done it before. So one of the things I like to bring up a lot is a cartoon that I describe in my second book, Tyranny of Oil. In the 1870s, there was similar problems to what we have right now. The biggest company was Standard Oil. Corporations were dominating our system, and a cartoon depicted it really well. It's a cartoon that depicts the United States Senate. They're sitting just like you are, a bunch of people in this room. Towering above them are these huge, fat cats in top hat and tails, which are identified as the corporate trusts. The only corporation that's named by name is Standard Oil. There's a banner that reads, the U.S. Senate, of the monopolist, by the monopolist, for the monopolist. And a little sign in the corner by a door like that that's locked and bolted and closed, and the sign says, People's Entrance. The response to this was a massive movement of political action, protests, strikes, shutdowns, lawsuits. The whole country got mobilized, and the result was the first laws that we ever had in our history on labor rules, such as, you know, the idea that maybe children shouldn't be doing labor, the crazy idea of the 40-hour work week and the 8-hour workday, the first campaign finance laws we've ever had, and antitrust laws, the first target of which was Standard Oil, which was then broken up into many, many, many corporate parts. Over the years, those corporate parts, particularly starting in the 1980s under Reagan, under deregulation, were allowed to put themselves back together again, like the water man in the Terminator, slowly pulling themselves back together. And that's, you know, Exxon and Mobil and Chevron and Texaco and Gulf and Getty, which are now one company, and Unocal, Conoco and Phillips, BP, which bought Amoco and ARCO. We allowed them to put themselves back together again. Well, guess what? We can do it again. We've already done it before.
For just joining us
here, here.
And also, the Senate was appointed, and at some point, the Senate became elected, right?
Great.
Antonia Juhas is author of Black Tide. Our other guest today at Climate One is Bill McKibben, founder of 350.org. I'm Greg Dalton. We're going to invite your participation and put the microphone up here and invite you to join us. The line starts over there with our producer, Jane Ann, and we invite you to join us with one-part question. We'll get in as many as we can in the 15 minutes we have left.
And while you're doing it, I just want to say something before, which is if anybody hasn't read Antonia's books, they really should. She's the exact example of the kind of reporting. There have been two great authors working on the oil industry. She's one, and Steve Call, whose book about Exxon, was the other. And, you know, this is the biggest force in our society, and it's tragically undercovered. And, you know, such credit to her for going and doing this kind of work.
I paid him to say that.
There's a podcast of Steve Call at Climate One in iTunes, and there's some great stories in there about getting into the command center for the BP oil spill that you got inside, and some people got escorted out. There's some good stories in there. Welcome to Climate One. Let's have our audience question.
Thank you. It seems to me that the big oil companies have a very big silent partner in us. A lot of people that I talk to, they say they recycle their bottles and cans and they turn the thermostat down at night. And then the only time they're really climate deniers is when they climb behind the wheel of their big SUVs or their four-door long bed pickup trucks and go down to the store for a bag of groceries. I don't think the message is getting through to us, and I know that we can do it if we want, because we just did it with the airlines a couple of weeks ago, or this last week. Is there a better way? Is there a direction we could go?
There's not a way to solve this problem in the time that we have by getting everybody to change their lifestyle. If we had 100 years, this is exactly the right way to approach this problem. Human beings change best in human civilizations when it goes slowly and gradually, and you know, you buy a Prius and your brother-in-law sees it, and you know, your sister rides the bicycle and gets, you know, starts looking healthy, and somebody else copies her, and on we go. You know, over three generations we make real change. We had three generations, good idea. We've got a few years, and that means that we engage. I mean, all those things are important, but if you have a limited quantity of time and energy, which most of us do, spend a little bit of it changing your light bulbs and perfecting your own lifestyle and whatever. Spend more of it organizing, getting connected, becoming powerful enough to make that structural reform. That was the logic anyway behind 350.org.
Dirt. And for all the little piggies, life is
is getting worse. Always having dirt to play around in. Have you seen the bigger piggies in the starched white shed? You will find the bigger piggies stirring up the dirt. Always have clean shirts to play around in.
Now for something completely different.